is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Now, you look at the Adelson family from the outside, if you don't know the whole story, and it's easy to be fooled. You got to think of it from the juror's perspective. If they don't know what's going on and they're seeing these people for the first time, what are they going to see? Because that's what matters, not what we know out here, not what we've been following for all these years, but what is a juror going to see when they go and sit in that courtroom and they see Donna Adelson and they see Harvey and they see Wendy all sitting out there and maybe the grandkids? What's going on here? Where's Charlie? Do they know about Charlie? Oh, they'll learn. They will learn. The surface story is glossy. A thriving South Florida dental practice, degrees from respected universities, well-dressed kids, and smiling photographs, family gatherings that look warm and effortless from the outside. But you don't have to scratch very deep to find a different truth. One that isn't about warmth at all. It's about gravity. Not the kind you learn in science class, but the kind that holds everyone in orbit around one person. For decades, that center of gravity has been Donna Adelson. Not the casual, flattering sense people use when they say matriarch, but in the literal sense of control. In this family, Donna's preferences weren't just opinions. They were defaults, allegedly. Her words didn't have to come with ultimatums. They carry their own kind of weight. And that weight could move people, even grown independent adults, apparently, in ways they might not have recognized until it was too late. Now, Donna is innocent until proven guilty. She has been charged with these crimes. All of this is alleged. So, allegedly, assume that's in front of everything we are talking about here. The state says that same gravitational pull played a central role in one of the most infamous murder-for-hire cases Florida has ever seen. The 2024 shooting of Florida State University law professor Dan Markell. Their theory, it is simple. The custody arrangement after Dan's divorce from Wendy Adelson kept their two sons in Tallahassee, far from Donna's home in Miami. Donna wanted them closer, and when Dan wouldn't agree to relocation, the state says the family found another way to solve the problem. But to understand why prosecutors believe Donna was more than just a background figure, you have to walk through the evidence like stepping stones, each one pulling you deeper into the picture of influence, control, and intent. The first stone is the $1 million relocation bribe. This wasn't whispered gossip at a family dinner. In court documents, prosecutors detail a concrete plan. Donna, Harvey, Charlie, and Wendy pulling $1 million to offer Dan if he'd agree to let the boys move to South Florida, where Donna was. It's a kind of number that stops you. $1 million? Not because the Adelsons couldn't afford it, but because it shows the scale of Donna's determination. This is not Wendy saying to her ex-husband, hey, I'll give you $1 million if they can move down here. Heck, you move down here too. Do whatever. Or if you want to stay there, that's fine, but let me make it worth your while more. I know you're going to have to travel more. Their families, there's ways of having this conversation that don't involve murder. This is a common conversation in many families where one has to move one place and one's the other, but it's usually because of a job or because of some opportunity or because of some sort of obligation, not necessarily because grandma is a narcissist. Although that does happen. You don't make $1 million offer unless the goal matters that much, and unless you have the power to rally everyone else into contributing, which is what Donna allegedly did. Gathered the Wagons, gathered the kids, everybody. Everybody was ready to pool in hundreds of thousands of dollars, allegedly, so Donna could be close to the grandkids. Not close to their father, close to their grandmother, who's literally trying to bribe dad to see his own children less so she could see them more. grandma really shouldn't even be part of this conversation. But Donna likes to insert herself into things, it seems. When that proposal did not get traction, the strategy shifted to something more personal, more cutting. This is where the religious leverage, that threat, comes in. According to state filings, Donna suggested telling Dan that if he didn't agree, the boys would be raised Catholic. Oh my gosh. To anyone outside the family, it might sound like a throwaway line, but for Dan, a man deeply committed to raising his children in the Jewish faith, it was a direct hit to his identity as a father. And that's not something you do. You don't threaten how you're going to raise the kids, because you're talking about religious identity. You're talking about core identity of an individual. People tend to take their religions pretty seriously. It tends to be like the core of who most people are if they're religious. And to say, I'm going to take the core of your child and raise them the way I want to, because I'm grandma. I know you're the father, but I know better. That's Donna Adelson. That's literally what she was allegedly proposing. I mean, just think of that for, take murder out of it. Who the hell, I shouldn't say who the hell does it. There's a lot of narcissistic grandmothers out there that think their opinion matters far more than their own children who gave birth to the child and the spouse. It was a direct hit to his identity as a father. And that's not just an emotional jab. That's weaponizing someone's values to pressure them into compliance. By this point, the relationship between Dan and Donna was fractured enough that he went to court and custody filings. Dan reported that his sons came back from time with Donna saying, Grandma Donna had told him their father was, quote, stupid, and that she hated him for taking her sunshines away. That's the third stone, the comments to grandchildren. On paper, it's hearsay from mouths of children. In reality, it's a glimpse of how loyalty is shaped at the youngest level in the scope of the Adelson household. If the prosecution could convince a jury that Donna was already working to align the children against their father, which she was, allegedly, it strengthens the idea that this wasn't just a dispute over location. It was about eliminating him as a parental influence. Then comes the morning of the murders. Here, the state leans heavily on phone records. The fourth stone in the path, Wendy calls Donna after Dan is shot. Minutes later, Donna calls Charlie. Minutes after that, Charlie's on the phone with Catherine McBonough. Who's Catherine McBonough? Well, she's not one of the Adelsons, if you've gathered that much. The woman already convicted of connecting him to the hired gunman. In isolation, it's just a string of calls, but lined up against the timeline of the shooting, it takes a different texture. The prosecution will call it choreography. Why are you calling the woman who's connected to the hitman right after the hit happens, Charlie? And does Donna have a connection there? It's not unreasonable to think that if you just found out your son-in-law was murdered in his driveway, that you would call the closest people to you, people who know him, people who are part of the family, even though obviously it's a divorce. Still the father of your grandchildren and Charlie's nieces, nephews. But influence isn't just in words or calls. Sometimes it's on paper with ink and signatures. Over the year following Dan's murder, 18 checks were issued from the Adelson Family Dental Office to Catherine McBonough. Each check, it was signed by Donna. Why is Donna writing checks to Catherine McBonough, the chick that Charlie was kind of dating, who has very close connections to the man who killed Donna's son-in-law, Dan Markell? Each check, again, signed by Donna. That's stone number five. The dental office checks. Prosecutors say these weren't wages for legitimate work. They were the payment stream that kept the people who carried out the hit from talking. And whether Donna saw them as hush money or just helping Charlie with his arrangements, her signature is there. 2 years later, the FBI declined to make a move on Donna. They decided to make a move on Donna. They didn't charge her immediately. They went after Charlie first, but before they went after Charlie, they staged what's known as a bump, an undercover agent approaching Donna with a fabricated blackmail note, hinting at knowledge of the murder. That's stone six, the FBI bump reaction. Donna didn't go to police. She went straight to Charlie. And in a recorded call, she described the issue as involving the two of us. That phrasing matters. Not you, not the family, us. Like the pact that you and two made together, us. It's the kind of slip the prosecutors will treat like gold. By late 2023, the walls were closing in. Other players had been convicted. The timeline was catching up to her, and that's when law enforcement arrested her at Miami International Airport with a one-way ticket to Vietnam. She's got a one-way ticket on a westbound train. Going to Vietnam. Stone 7. It's not Paris, not New York. Vietnam, a country with no extradition treaty with the United States. Prosecutors call it a getaway plan. The defense will almost certainly try to spin it as, it's a vacation. We went there a long time ago. We always go with one-way tickets. But the date on that ticket, it matched the day she was taken into custody. Donna's involvement in her children's legal battles don't start with the murder. Stone 8 is the divorce and custody file. Years of documented involvement, strategy shaping, and behind-the-scenes coaching during Wendy's split from Dan. Those allegations, the judge has ruled that only parts of that file can come into the trial. But those parts matter. They help show a long arc of control stretching back well before anyone picked up a phone to hire a hitman. Then there's the unwritten but well-documented Family First Code. Shows up in recorded calls and in the testimony of those who know the Adelsons. Outsiders are obstacles. Insiders protect one another. It's not stated like a mission statement, but it's there, woven into conversations. And when that's the code, morality can bend. If protect the family becomes the prime directive, the methods stop mattering as much. And finally, the prior convictions of co-conspirators, Charlie Adelson and Catherine McBona, have already been found guilty. The state doesn't have to prove the conspiracy, that it existed, only that Donna was knowing and an active part of it. None of these stones on their own are the smoking gun. But together they form a path, one that starts with influence and ends with a man dead in his driveway. The jury will have to decide whether Donna was simply walking alongside that path or lying the stones herself. And here's a psychological piece that will linger in that jury room. In families where no isn't an option, the callous changes. When the matriarch wants something, the question isn't, will someone act? It's how far will they go to deliver it? The prosecution will say that in this family, the distance between a wish and an act was shorter than anyone outside that circle could have ever imagined. When the trial begins, jurors will hear the call, see the checks, read the words in those filings. They'll watch Donna at the defense table and try to map what they see onto what they've heard. And they'll be left with that central choice, grandmother or architect. Because if they decide she was the latter, every other role she's played, mother, matriarch, business owner, it gets eclipsed by one truth. She was the gravity. And gravity doesn't just hold things in place. It pulls. I'm curious to get your thoughts on this case. Let me know in the comments on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. and let us know your thoughts, and be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading podcasts. You can strip away someone's freedom. You can confiscate their passport, seize their bank accounts, and lock them in a cell with nothing but four walls and a scratchy blanket. You can make them dependent on a schedule they don't choose, a menu they didn't order, or a set of rules they didn't write. But if a person has spent decades living through their ability to control a narrative, to shape how others see them, there's one thing they can carry into any cage: their voice. And with Donna Adelson, that voice is still very active, still working, still reaching. Most defendants in her position accused of first-degree murder, conspiracy, solicitation, they start conversing their words once they're behind bars. They shrink the scope of their conversations. They avoid anything that could get them in deeper trouble. You conserve your words. They talk about the weather, the food, their health. Short sentences, safe topics. Donna, well, Donna's not been in prison before. And Donna, well, she allegedly likes to perform. And she's still performing. Even in recorded jail calls, where she knows every syllable is monitored, she speaks like someone building a case. Not a legal case in a courtroom, but a personal case for her own innocence, her own story, her own version of the truth. It's in her pacing. Deliberate, not rushed. Never letting her voice crack in a way that would give her listener or the unseen audience the satisfaction of hearing desperation. She'll acknowledge the trial, the accusations, the headlines, but she packages them in language that makes her seem reasonable, misunderstood, unfairly targeted, you know, like narcissists do. It's not accidental. That's years of practicing image management in real time. One of the strongest tells is her use of inclusive language with family. We and us instead of me and I. She doesn't say they're coming after me. She says they're coming after us. She's inclusive. It's a small shift in words with a big payoff. It collapses the emotional distance between her legal crisis and the person she's speaking to. It reforms her trouble as their trouble collectively, turning a relative into a co-defendant in spirit, even if not in law. And once you're part of the us, breaking from her narrative doesn't feel like just disagreeing. It feels like betrayal. In some calls, she'll pivot abruptly from high-stakes legal talk to something mundane, commissary food, a piece of prison gossip, a comment about the weather outside. On the surface, it's conversational filler. Underneath, it's minimization. By placing a conversation about the possibility of life in prison right next to a remark about snack prices, she's signaling to the listeners, this isn't as dire as it sounds. We're still in control here. It's an emotional regulator for them and for herself. When she edges towards dangerous territory, she doesn't blurt or stumble. She slides into vagueness. You know how that went? We talked about that before. Enough for the listener to fill in the blanks. Nothing concrete for prosecutors to play back in court as a smoking gun. That's a careful admission. A skill you see in people who've spent a lifetime navigating conversations where the stakes are high. She can keep the subtext intact while stripping the road or the record of anything explicitly damaging. Over multiple calls, another pattern emerges, the way her tone morphs to fit her audience. With family, her voice is warmer, more intimate, infused with shared grievance. We've been through so much. They're not being fair to us. She's the wronged insider building solidarity. But in conversations that could reach lawyers, media, or other outsiders, she becomes calm, composed, almost formal. This is audience-specific tailoring, and it's deliberate. It ensures that each person hears the Donna Adelson she wants them to see. She also uses these calls to reframe past events. Now, keep in mind, like I said earlier, Donna Adelson is innocent until proven guilty. All of these are allegations. So assume allegations are allegedly is in front of everything. She also uses these calls to reframe past events. Decisions that in court filings, well, they look calculated and incriminating. But they're retold as logical, harmless, or even selfless. She edits the memory in real time, knowing that this version will be what sticks if the call is ever replayed. It isn't nostalgia, it's planting alternative narratives in a way that feels casual, but is in fact meticulous. And then there's her laughter. Not the belly laugh of amusement, but a quick, light chuckle. Follows a reference of something deadly serious, charges, timelines, evidence. The laugh says, don't take this too seriously. It's not just self-soothing. It's not just self-soothing. I don't know why Alexa answered me there, but it did. It's not just self-soothing. It's signaling to the listener that they shouldn't take it too seriously either. It's emotional steering, diffusing the weight of reality so her allies stay steady. When blame creeps forward, she redirects it outward. Then the system, the media, the antagonist is always faceless, always external. This is more than self-protection. It's narrative positioning. If she's not the cause of the chaos, then the people around her can cast her as a victim, and victims deserve defending. Her denial is absolute. No hedging, no softening. Even when the evidence she's denying is already public. The kind of categorical denial has power. It tells allies there's no reason to doubt her. It tells potential sympathizers in the public sphere that she's unwavering, and it leaves no maybe on the tape that prosecutors could twist. Her voice itself is a tool. It drops to a near whisper when she's inviting sympathy. It sharpens to a point when she's creating urgency. It softens when she's coaxing agreement. She's not just recounting events, she's orchestrating the listener's emotional response to them. That's the kind of communication control you develop over years at home, in business, in conflict, as a narcissistic mother. And then there are the lines that sound rehearsed, perfectly self-contained, neatly quotable. They sound for the person on the call, they're for anyone who might hear it later. Jurors, reporters, documentarians, they're planting markers in the official record, moments designed to survive and be repeated. It's performance layered on top of conversation. And all of this adds up to a form of control that's as much about survival as it is about vanity. The legal system controls every tangible part of her life right now. But every time she picks up that phone, she steps back into the role she's most comfortable in. The director, the narrator, the one framing the story for the people around her. And it's not just about protecting her in the here and now. If you're thinking long-term, those calls are part of her legacy. They're the version of her voice and story that will exist in public archives, court exhibits, maybe in documentaries years from now. That's why when every omission, every carefully placed laugh matters. They're all stitches in a quilt she wants the world to see instead of the one prosecutors will hold up at the trial. For someone prosecutors say spent decades as the matriarch, the fixer, the strategist, a woman who could align her family like chess pieces, letting go of that steering wheel might be impossible. We talked about the story here. It was about control shaping her family's decisions. This is how it played out under the harshest light possible. Those recorded calls, public scrutiny, the full weight of the legal system pressing down. Inside the walls, her family is still her first audience, but outside, the world is second. And Donna Adelson, even now, seems determined to manage both. Is she doing it well, though? Is she being effective at directing her image to others? She did it for years with her kids. Her kids went along with it. Yes, mother, whatever you say.
And now she seems to think that jurors, the court, the public, the media will do the same. Tell me what you think in the comments section on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi if you're not already there, and be sure to press subscribe. One of the most revealing moments in any criminal trial comes before the witness, the first witness, is sworn in. It is the decision every defendant has to make. Will I testify? For most defendants, especially in cases involving serious felonies like first-degree murder, the answer is no, they don't take the stand. They let their lawyers speak for them. It's not because they're hiding, it's because the risk is enormous. When you're in that witness box, the rules change. You're no longer sitting quietly while your attorney objects, projects, and reframes. You are the focus. The prosecution controls the questions, the timing, and the tone. And the jury, the people who will decide whether you go home or spend the rest of your life in a cell, they're watching your every blink, pause, and inflection. That's why Donna Adelson's apparent willingness, some say eagerness, to testify in her own defense is one of the most surprising and, frankly, most telling developments in this case. It's not common, and when it does happen, it usually means one of two things. Sometimes it means the defendant truly believes their own innocence story will carry the day. They think, if I can just tell my side of the story, people will understand. They'll get it. Other times it's rooted in ego. The belief that they're the best, most persuasive person to speak on their behalf. They may not trust their lawyers to get the tone exactly right or to hammer home the points that they think are essential. And sometimes it's about control. Taking back the microphone in a process where every other part of their life has been seized. The personality that chooses to testify under this level of risk, well, let's just say it overlaps with certain traits we've seen in Donna before. And yes, again, all allegedly, we're talking about narcissistic control. A high need for it. Confidence, sometimes overconfidence in their ability to read a room. A history of steering conversations, whether in family disputes, business, or public life. The underlying belief is this: if I can just get in front of those jurors, I can make them see it my way. And before that in life, it was, if I can just get in front of this problem, if I can just speak to the people before they hear about this over here that's going to make me look bad, I can steer the narrative, the emotions, the feelings, the reactions that people will naturally have to my decisions. And if I don't like their reaction, well, I can find a way to fix it. I think Donna's allegedly done that quite a bit throughout her life. And it's worked. Otherwise, she wouldn't be sticking with these strategies. For someone who's been the central voice in their family for decades, who's influenced decisions and shaped narratives from the inside out, staying silent might feel impossible. The witness's stand offers a direct connection to the jury, unfiltered by attorneys, unmuted by objections. It's the purest form of self-presentation left in the trial process, but it's also the most dangerous. Prosecutors love a defendant who wants to testify because it gives them the chance to use the defendant's own words against them live. In front of the jury, they'll start with the obvious, the relocation bribe emails, the raise them Catholic conversation, the phone records from the morning of the murder, the dental office checks to Catherine McBona, the FBI bump recordings, the one-way ticket to Vietnam. Each of those becomes a pointed question, not an abstract accusation, but a you did this, explain it now sort of thing. And in cross-examination, explanations are traps. If you answer too fast, you seem rehearsed. Too slow, you look like you're inventing a story. Contradict yourself and the prosecutor pounces. Even a truthful answer can be framed to sound suspicious if the prosecutor controls the order and the emphasis. I've seen it play out in other high-profile cases. Jodi Arias in 2013 testified for 18 days in her own murder trial. She was articulate, she was composed, and it backfired. Jurors later said that the more she talked, the less they believed her. The sheer length of her testimony gave the prosecution endless opportunities to highlight inconsistencies and points to manipulations. Alec Murdaugh in 2023 took the stand in his double murder trial. He admitted to some lies, denied the murders, and tried to come across as candid. Jurors said later that his testimony confirmed what the prosecution had been saying all along, that he was skilled at manipulating people and situations to serve his own ends. Oscar Pistorius, South Africa, testified in his trial for killing Rivera Steenkamp. He tried to control the narrative, but under cross-examination, he became emotional, defensive, and inconsistent. The judge later referenced his testimony as part of why she didn't believe his account. And those are just the headline cases. In smaller trials I've followed, I've seen defendants talk themselves right into conviction, not because they admitted guilt outright, but because they gave the jury a reason to distrust them. An inconsistent statement, a flash of arrogance, a refusal to answer directly. Donna Adelson, if she takes the stand, she's stepping into all of that. The reason she might do it, ego, control, belief in her own persuasiveness. Well, congratulations, Donna. Keep believing in yourself. Please do. Are the same reasons it can and will go wrong. Here's another wrinkle. This could be a part of a broader family strategy. In a case where the Adelsons have been portrayed as tight, coordinated in a unit, the matriarch stepping up to testify could be meant to send a message. It could be about optics, showing confidence, projecting unity, implying she has nothing to hide. But if that's the play, it's a dangerous one. Because unlike a pretrial statement or a media interview, testimony is under oath with penalties for perjury. And in a setting where every word can be dissected, the psychological downside, if it backfires, it's immense. Jurors remember moments, not transcripts. And if she comes off as combative when pressed, if she appears to dodge a direct question, if her tone shifts into condescension, those impressions can outweigh even the strongest defense arguments. Jurors are human. They read body language. They know when someone pauses too long, looks away, or answers a question, or answers with a question instead of a statement. They pick up on micro expressions, that half second flash of irritation, which Donna is very good at, that quick smirk, that tightening of the jaw. And they talk about it in deliberations. If they say humility, sincerity, and consistency, they might give her the benefit of the doubt. But while Donna thinks she's projecting that, she's always projecting something very, very different. She just doesn't understand that other people don't see her the way she sees herself. If they see defensiveness, control tactics, or what they interpret as manipulation, which is how Donna comes across, it can cement a guilty vote before closing arguments even begin. And here's the brutal truth. Prosecutors will work to make those moments happen. They'll press on sensitive points. They'll circle back to earlier answers to expose contradictions. They'll bring out documents that undercut her version of events. They'll frame questions in ways that force her to either agree with damaging statements or appear evasive. Testifying is the ultimate high wire act. For Donna, it's not just a legal decision, it's an identity test. If she's lived her entire life as the voice in the room that people listen to, that people follow, stepping into that witness box may feel like the only way to be herself in the middle of a process designed to strip her of control. But that's also the trap, because in the courtroom, she's not the one directing the conversation anymore. The very traits that may have served her in family disputes, business negotiations, and social settings, confidence, persistence, strategic framing, can read very differently to a jury hearing them in the shadow of murder charges. So if she takes the stand, it's not going to be any Wheel of Fortune appearance. It won't just be a legal move. It'll be a psychological gamble, one that tells us as much about who Donna Adelson believes she is as it does about her defensive strategy. The witness box will become her stage, and the jury will decide whether they're watching a credible truth teller or the final act of a performance that's been years in the making. Let me know your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If not there already, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi so you can find us there. Do the same if you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case. Whatever verdict comes down in Donna Adelson's trial, the truth is the Adelson's family life and legacy has already been rewritten in permanent ink. The ripple effect of this case is not confined to a courtroom in Tallahassee or the Florida Department of Corrections. It extends outward into living rooms, schools, workplaces, community gatherings, shaping identities, relationships, and reputations in ways that will outlast prison sentences and headlines. The son is already serving life. Charlie, without parole for orchestrating the murder of his former brother-in-law. A daughter lives under the shadow of implication. Never charged, but permanently associated with the crime in the public mind. Grandchildren are growing up with a story about their family that they didn't choose, can't change, and will become confronted with again and again as they get older. And now the matriarch faces the possibility of dying in prison. These are the conditions that create intergenerational trauma. Trauma that isn't just about the event itself, but about how it's remembered, talked about, and carried forward by people who weren't even present when it happened. For the grandchildren, the psychological task ahead is staggering. In early childhood, grandma is a simple role. The person who visits, gives hugs, maybe slips a piece of candy into a hand. That's the image they start with. At some point, whether throughout overhearing adult conversations, stumbling across news coverage, or being told directly at school, that image is going to collide with something very different. The woman in those holiday photos is accused of orchestrating a murder. The murder of your father. Reconciling those two realities requires a kind of mental gymnastics that most adults struggle with, let alone children. Do they split into two people in their minds? The loving grandmother and the alleged conspirator, and keep those separate? Do they merge them into one complicated, very flawed person, or do they reject one entirely, either cutting her out of their memory or refusing to believe the accusations altogether? None of these options come without cost. And this isn't a private struggle. In a case with this level of media coverage, the world knows the family's name. At school, at college, in the workplace, peers and colleagues can connect the dots in a second, with a search. That can mean direct confrontation, questions, judgments, even harassment, or the subtler but equally corrosive experience of feeling watched and whispered about. That's where the question of identity takes center stage. Do you keep the Adelson name and live with the constant recognition, change it to create distance, at the risk of feeling like you've erased part of yourself, even if they change it? The digital age, the link is still just a few clicks away. That kind of inherited notoriety can shape career choices, social networks, even where someone decides to live. That's what these grandchildren, Wendy's kids, have to face. For the adults in the family, the problem is different, but no less severe. How do you maintain loyalty to a loved one convicted of a serious crime without losing credibility in your community? Some relatives will stay firmly in the camp of support, visiting, writing letters, advocating for appeals. Others will create distance, publicly or privately, to protect themselves or their children from being drawn into the glare of the case. Both choices carry emotional weight. Support can mean aligning yourself with someone the public sees as dangerous. Distance can mean living with guilt or stepping back. The guilt takes many forms. There's survivor's guilt. I still have my freedom. They don't. Complicity guilt. I should have seen this coming. I should have stopped it. Guilt by association. I didn't do this, but the world looks at me differently because I'm part of this family. Left unaddressed, guilt can harden into shame. And shame is corrosive. It isolates. It silences. It keeps people from seeking help. One coping mechanism that appears in families like this is denial, sometimes total, sometimes selective. The story gets rewritten. The charges were exaggerated. The witnesses lied. The trial was rigged. It's in its most protective form. Denial allows family members to keep loving the convicted person without confronting the weight of what happened. But it also freezes a story in a way that prevents healing. You can't process grief or anger about something you insist never took place. And if younger family members are raised in an atmosphere of denial, they may grow up without the tools to talk honestly about the event or their feelings about it. There's another danger here. In families where prosecutors allege control and manipulation, those dynamics can survive a conviction. Influence doesn't necessarily die when a prison door closes. Letters, phone calls, even conversations during visits can be used to reinforce loyalty, direct behavior, or maintain the family narrative. If someone has spent decades in a position of authority within the family, that role doesn't automatically dissolve with sentencing. For younger or more dependent relatives, the pull can be very strong. The community's role in all this can't be underestimated either. In a high-profile case, the community isn't just the neighborhood. It's the broader public audience. Every social interaction is filtered through what people think they know about the case. For some families, the judgment comes in silence. Invitations not extended, conversations that die when you walk into a room. In other cases, it's vocal and aggressive. Confrontations, taunts, or public shaming. Either way, the effect is to limit the safe spaces where the family can breathe and be themselves. That kind of isolation can delay or derail emotional recovery. In some rare situations, families in this position make a deliberate choice to engage publicly, to give interviews, to tell their side, to become activists for reform. That's one way to reclaim agency, but it's a high-risk move. It can backfire if the public sees it as self-serving or if new evidence contradicts the family statements. And as for the children, it can mean growing up in a public battle they did not choose. So what's a long-term prognosis for a family like this from a psychological standpoint? The best-case scenario to slow intentional rebuilding of trust within the family. Honest acknowledgement of what happened, and a separation of individual identities from the family's collective reputation. That means giving each member, especially the younger ones, permission to define themselves on their own terms, without inheriting the guilt or defense of older generations or following the orders of them. The worst case scenario is a closed loop of denial and loyalty where the next generation inherits not just the name, but the unresolved conflict. In those situations, the crime remains the organizing principle of the family, not as an event in the past, but as the live wire running through every interaction, shaping choices for decades. For the public, there's the broader takeaway here. We're quick to focus on the defendant, the trial, the verdict, but in cases like this, the blast radius is wider. It includes people who never set foot in the crime scene, never spoke to a lawyer, never appeared on a witness list, but who will live with the fallout for the rest of their lives. It's a reminder that crimes of this scale don't just create a victim and a perpetrator. They create concentric circles of impact. Each one altering the lives inside in ways that they cannot be undone. For Donna Adelson, the verdict will decide where she spends her remaining years. For her family, the sentence has already started. The question now is whether they can find a way to keep that sentence from defining the next generation as completely as it has defined this one. Tell me your thoughts in the comments section. If you're not on YouTube already, find us there. You can watch us do all of these stories and comment. We'd love to have you there. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe while you're there and search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi wherever you get podcasts as well, so you can take us on the go and listen wherever you may be. Love to hear your thoughts on this case as this trial begins to ramp up for Donna Adelson. We'll be covering it every single day, so press subscribe so you don't miss any of our trial coverage here at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.